Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I am doing well despite Bill being the subject of ridicule and attack this morning by Howard Dean.
Howard Dean.
Howard Dean.
Why
So
is
what
Howard Dean
happened?
punching down on you, Matt?
Thank you, Bill. We'll go to North Dakota. Yeah! So that's my Dean scream. No, you know, what happened was he was saying some mean things about National Review today and other conservatives, and I just tweeted that he needed to get off the decaf. And
Where is he
Joe,
making these comments?
sorry, this is on MSNBC's Morning Joe, which I was watching and drinking my Starbucks, and I saw that, and so I tweeted that Dean needed to get off the decaf. And Joe and Willie Geist read that to him. And then he called the Daily Caller a propaganda organization or something to that effect. But I come here, you know, I thought this was a good time to talk. It's interesting because it's been a decade since Howard Dean ran for president. And it just occurred to me that it had been a decade, and it's amazing. And I think despite the fact that he was criticizing me today, or my outlet today, his campaign sort of inspired me to start blogging. And, you know, in 03, and Trippi's book, which I read in 04, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, was a great book. So I think it's time to commemorate this decade. And, Bill, I know you have a special tie-in to the Dean campaign as well.
Well, sure. It was 10 years ago this month when I became the first blogger in history to formally interview a presidential candidate, namely Howard Dean. I actually was trying to interview them all, but only the Dean campaign responded. If everyone ever puts together a blog trivia book, I get that. I get that on the obituary.
Very good.
And you know, Dean, I think Dean gets a degree of credit for being an innovator, for embracing blogging, for embracing meetup.com, for embracing internet organizing before anyone really thought that was doable, that you could organize people offline using online tools. You know, that was a Dean innovation. And obviously that has now everyone's doing it.
Right.
But I think
Well, and I think it might have been more of a Trippi innovation, actually. I mean, Dean ran a sort of a fiscally conservative governor of Vermont who was basically a Luddite, and I think they seized this opening to be from the Democratic wing of the Democrat Party and to tap into the internet, and I think it really worked. It was an act of desperation. I mean, you couldn't have won or had a chance of winning if Howard Dean runs as a traditional candidate. They had to shake things up and be a little risky, and I think the internet thing played into that.
Well, I think you are. I mean, there are two separate things, I think. One is the technological innovations, which I agree. I mean, they're Trippi driven. Dean accepted them, but he was not, he was not writing the code. But there's the message aspect of Dean, which I think also is a sustaining legacy of the campaign. And it's not just that he said. He's representing the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, hearkening to Paul Wellstone. That's part of it, but you know, there's a reason why I think Dean got as far as he did, and say Denis Kucinich did not. I mean, if it was just about being as purist on the left as possible, Kucinich would have lapped Dean easily, and that's not what happened. But Dean had this mixture of brash rhetoric and unapologetic rhetoric, but also combined with a broad appeal to constituencies that were not traditionally democratic. You know, he was trying to show that you could take the best of liberalism and sell it elsewhere, and that
Right.
required using different rhetoric than perhaps the Kucinichs of the world were comfortable doing. You know, and the classic.
Right. And of course Dean goes on to become the DNC chair has his 50-state strategy, doesn't get a lot of credit. And I would argue that Barack Obama, Howard Dean may have very well been the forerunner that paved the way for Barack Obama sort of leading them to the promised land. And I don't think Dean gets the credit for that.
No, I think Dean deserves credit. I mean, I think Obama, you know, perfected it in many ways. But they both tried to take liberal principles and articulate them differently and make them more palatable to the broader electorate of the country and was eager to show that could work in purple states and some red states. You know, and sort of the classic Dean example of this, I mean, Obama's style is definitely different. But the Dean example was in that first speech in February 2003, where he really kind of grabbed the collar of the Democratic Party, opens his speech by saying, "What I want to know is why in the world the Democratic Party leadership is supporting the president's unilateral attack on Iraq." I mean, that just sort of punctured this confusion in the party. What was going on? When is someone going to speak the truth? And so everyone got kind
of... He's the only guy saying it at the time. Right. All the other Democrats are trying to show that they're just as tough as Bush. Right. Just as pro-war as Bush, and Dean seizes this opportunity.
Right. And then, you know, there's just a different style than the Kucinich style of talking about this is an illegal war under this UN resolution, blah blah blah, and that kind of stuff doesn't travel.
He's not being whiny about it; he's being tough about it.
Right. But then later in the speech, you know, and this line gets forgotten because it got him into trouble later. By the time he said it was widely praised and it was applauded in the room. "I intend to talk about race during this election in the South because Republicans have been talking about it since 1968 in order to divide us. I'm going to bring us together because you know what? White folks in the South who drive pickups with Confederate flag decals on the back ought to be voting with us and not them because their kids don't have health insurance and their kids need better schools too." And he said that in front of a multiracial audience. Wild applause. You know, everyone got it when he said it then. He's saying we can go to parts of the country where we're not welcome right now, and we have a case to make, and we should not ignore voters because we have differences of opinion on other things. The way he said it there, it wasn't like, let's suck up to people who are racist. Like, he wasn't saying that. But when he said a version of that later in the campaign, kind of off the cuff and not as well crafted. He got kind of pegged as sort of kissing up to racists, and that was part of the decline of the D campaign later. But I do
this happens more often than people think. Where, you know, a lot of times lines that turn into gaffes, they're not the first time they say it. They've been saying it before. Either they've gotten away with saying it before because no one noticed, or they said it slightly different in a speech, and then they're sort of paraphrasing themselves, and they get in trouble. This happens quite a bit, and it's interesting. I think Dean had to apologize for that, in fact.
I mean, later identity, I think he did the penance with Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, if I recall. But that divergence aside, the essence of what Dean was saying was that we don't have to be ashamed of our liberal views. We can articulate them better and show how they can help people regardless of where they are on the ideological spectrum. I think that attitude was picked up by Obama. Obama ran a campaign that wasn't, you know, Dick Morris style triangulation. There are wrinkles. I think sometimes people cherry pick certain lines and say, well, he's leaning right. He's eschewing government. He's cloaking what he really believes. And I think if you look at the totality of Obama's rhetoric, it's not that simple. I think the essence of it still is a liberal thrust with tweaks to say, to try to not lead with one's chin.
I think it's fair to say that Dean helped redefine liberalism, and I don't think he gets the credit that he deserves. It's the 10-year anniversary of that effort. I think he, in many ways, paved the way for not just Obama, but, you know, you ended up having people, you know, talk about the guy driving around with the gun rack in his truck. I mean, Jim Webb and others who would go on to win in 2 years after Dean, and It's been a decade. I don't think he got the credit. And then the scream, you know, the Dean scream, which I was mocking earlier, was not fair to Dean. You know, I was talking to Tucker Carlson a few minutes ago out here, and he was there and said, you know, he was excited. Everybody was excited there. But when they isolated the audio, it seemed so weird. But if you were there, it did not seem weird. And, of course, that video went viral. And if Dean wasn't finished by his third place finish in Iowa, he was certainly finished after that video aired.
Well, and it's episodes like that, which one of the things that sort of made Dean a bit of a rough vehicle for this approach. He was not the most polished candidate the things that unfair, but a polished candidate doesn't get himself into unfair situations or avoids them more often than not. And Dean wasn't that kind of a candidate. But so that tends to obscure what legacy achievements he has, he did make. And I think you stated very well. He redefined modern liberalism for the Democratic Party. I think that's a fair assessment.
And
much as you could say the same about Michelle Bachmann. We should be doing a Bachmann tribute, shouldn't we? Didn't Bachmann redefine modern American conservatism, and she's getting the same plaudits today?
Well, I think it's a good segue because here's where I think they're opposites, because Bachmann, you know, there are people who run for president that shouldn't win and shouldn't be taken seriously, really. I mean, Mike Huckabee is another example. Like Howard Dean, of someone who ran for president, should have been a third-tier candidate and ends up becoming a star. And I think that Huckabee, and Dean, you know, benefited greatly from having run for president. Even though they lost, they went from being nobodies to being, you know, household names, sort of. The other end of that spectrum, I say, are people like the aforementioned Dennis Kucinich and Michelle Bachmann, who are House members who run and gain this attention, but it hurts them back home, and it creates problems and sows the seed of sows the seed of their, you know, sort of leaving the public. I know Howard Dean is doing stuff on Fox News now, and Michelle Bachmann very well may end up on Fox News as well. But my point is that some people prosper greatly from presidential runs and some people don't. And I think that Michelle Bachmann, you know, I would say hubris and ambition got in the way of what could have been, I would argue, a much more effective voice for conservatism if she'd only kept the lower profile.
Now, I mean, the Bachmann style was very brash, pugnacious, quick to level a charge of, you know, that there are communist in Congress and Obama spends a zillion dollars on foreign trips and those types of things. Some have said that lots of her claims do not check out on the facts. Do we think that her brand of politicking was good for conservatism or bad for conservatism? Do conservatives want to see more Michelle Bachmanns or less Michelle Bachmanns now?
Well, I think conservatives are divided. You've got people like Mark Stein, who was filling in for Rush Limbaugh the other day and talked about how great Bachmann was and how she really added to the presidential race and the debates. I mean, that's not how I remember it. I remember her basically, you know, providing cover for Mitt Romney while she attacked conservatives like Rick Perry over Gardasil and Newt Gingrich. So I think she was... Whether it was a conspiracy or a coincidence, I think that she was, you know, she was very helpful in electing the most moderate candidate running. Well, the most moderate candidate with a chance of winning. Interestingly, John Huntsman attempted to do a reverse Dean, which was he saw an opening to be instead of being the most well. Instead of being the most conservative candidate, he became the, he tried to sort of become the most liberal candidate, and it failed miserably. So Huntsman tried the reverse Dean of seeing that opening of a niche that was unexploited. In this case, it was a bad idea. I think that Bachman, David Ferdoso, who is a really good center-right reporter for the DC Examiner, and he has this, started this new thing called conservativeintel.com, and he wrote what I think is the best piece about Bachman's legacy, which is to say conservatives are better off with her gone because she said all sorts of controversial things that embarrassed other conservatives. But more importantly, she spent like $12 million every 2 years to get reelected. So you might think that raising a lot of money is a good thing, but Ferdoso argues that it was an example of poor resource allocation, that in fact, rather than spend $12 million or whatever to reelect, you know, Michelle Bachman in some like random district in Minnesota, conservatives could elect 10 conservative Republicans in other districts. So he sees it as a good thing, and I'm inclined to think he's probably right.
Couldn't one argue that the power of Michelle Bachman was worth 10 conservatives, the way she spoke truth in the media and punctured the false narrative of Obama, that we to lose that would be to lose so much?
Yeah, some people say that. I think those people are wrong. That's an argument that you would expect from a certain wing of the conservative movement to advance. And I think Mark Stein, as I mentioned, would probably be in that camp.
I mean, it just seems to me.
I think you could argue that Michelle Bachman is a net, that her existence existence as a Republican. You could certainly argue that she's a net positive. I don't think I buy into that, but you could argue that having her in Congress is a net positive. But I think that if you said to me, here's, you know, $10 million that you could use to elect conservatives to Congress, you could either give it all to Bachman and she could squeak by with a 1 percentage point win in some Minnesota 6th district or something, or you could spread that wealth around a little bit and elect, you know, 5 or 10 conservatives who are going to, you know, maybe keep their mouth shut and, you know, pass legislation. They're going to be a solid vote on the right to life, on defending the Second Amendment. I think I'd go with that option.
Well, I mean, this raises the question, what do conservatives need to do now? Do they need to be, and forgive my choice of words, do you want an anti-intellectual leader like Michelle Bachman? You know, Michelle Bachman's not an ideas politician. You know, she has no signature proposal that she is associated with. You know, her function was to be an attack dog and to toss off one-liners. I mean, that's what she did. And you could argue that, you know, in today's media world, that's what you need. You know, you need someone that's going to, you know, throw a good punch. But others might think that, you know what, conservatism is on the short end right now. You know, we haven't recovered from the Bush years. People don't look at us as being serious about governing. We need to prove otherwise. We need to have someone who has good ideas that people think are relevant to the problems of today. I mean, Michelle Bachman is just not that person. But I mean, is there a sense on the right like that is the divide that she represents one side of?
Yeah, I think that conservatives are divided over her. I mean, I suspect that a lot of grassroots conservatives and people who are low information voters, but who lean conservative, love her because she goes on Fox News. She's very attractive. She's telegenic. She says interesting, you know, controversial things. And she's a fighter for us. And I think that, you know, conservatives who are, you know, at places like National Review, the aforementioned National Review, also derided by the aforementioned Dennis Kucinich, you know, if you got them alone over a beer, they would probably tell you that they think she's a joke. They may not say that publicly. But my thing is, I don't understand why we can't have it all. Like, it's not like this is a zero-sum game, you know, sort of thing, or whether, you know, there does seem to be an inverse relationship between being charismatic and being intellectual, but it needn't be that way. I mean, I don't understand why you can't have people who are, simultaneously solid conservatives and telegenic and interesting, but also serious about governing and serious about learning about conservative philosophy and public policy, and also conservative in the sense that that they're moderate temperamentally. I would say conservative temperamentally. Like, I don't understand why you can't have all of those things. I think Reagan was those things, by and large. It's exceptions. And I think Marco Rubio fits into that rubric. And I think that being able to communicate conservatism in a way that doesn't sell out, moderate, but also is compelling, like, why shouldn't it be that way? Why, and my hope is that there was a backlash against Bushism, which I think was completely appropriate on the right. And the Tea Party movement, I think, could be seen as a very good thing and a very healthy thing. But I just hope that it matures over time and that you end up having, more Rubios and less Bachmans.
Well, I want to point out that I mentioned before reading the Reagan biography Dutch right now, so I'm nearing the end of it, and so I just want to, Reagan gets tossed off very casually on the right a lot, but I think the way you did it just there is very accurate. I mean, Reagan had ideas. I mean, you might have thought they were the wrong ideas. You might even thought they weren't even well fleshed out ideas, but they were ideas. The guy actually, when he was governor, I mean, he was very serious about drastically changing the state's welfare program, and he ended up compromising with Democrats over it, but he got a lot of what he wanted. He also had a vision of how to handle the protesters at Berkeley, and that meant getting into the thick of it with the trustees there. That was a vision he had how the public education system should be administered, and even what was derided as Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, people thought that it wasn't very scientifically well grounded, but it was an idea, it was a dream, it was a proactive thing to do that he tried to rally the country around. He was also a good with a one liner and could throw a nice right jab. He wasn't a patsy. But he had visions of where he wanted the country to go that he articulated that involved concrete things to do. And Rubio's doing that now with immigration, that there is a way to do that and not just be a two-dimensional, TV caricature the way Bachman is. People always say, let's be like Reagan. And I think a lot of folks don't even stop to think, what does that mean? What is different about a Reagan than a Bachman? I think ideas is probably a big part of it.
Absolutely. But I think it's a shame because I think Michelle Bachman, she's not stupid. I think that she could have become a much more effective advocate for conservatism had she not gone on TV immediately and radio so much, not played up to that, pandered to the base as much. Had she surrounded herself with a trusted, loyal, and reliable staff that she maintained, had she not run for president talk about hubris, talk about ambition. Somebody who, I think she'd only been in Congress a few terms, and she was obviously a member of the lower house running for president, and talking up the fact that she was, a native Iowan or born in Iowa, not Minnesota, the people she actually represented. We're talking about Iowa, her connection to Iowa. And then taking on too much and the gaffes that happened, John Wayne Gacy, the Gardasil stuff, then the allegations of impropriety and FEC violations that are haunting her now, which probably led, at least partially led to her decision not to seek another term. it's a shame because I think that Michelle Bachmann could have become, and maybe not as famous, but a more effective voice for conservatism had she used her talents, you know, differently.
The conservatives will have to decide what to do in the post-Bachmann world. But I think conservatives are still pretty happy that there's a lot of scandal coverage out there on the Obama administration. And it seems like the thing that's getting the most attention this week is Eric Holder and the various investigations of the media that have been going on. And this strikes me as interesting because, and I think you wrote about this in a different context or a few days ago, conservatives usually are defending prosecutors when they investigate the media. They usually have an anti-media bias, not an anti, you know, government prosecution bias. But this is getting kind of wrapped up in a sense of Obama governmental overreach. So I sense that conservatives are gleefully sticking to, and then like Holder in the first place because of what they see as hatred towards guns or Fast and Furious and other stuff like that. So the latest flap is that Holder wants to have a meeting with the bureau chiefs of Washington media outlets, but he wanted off the record, and so there was guffaw. And I go, he's attacking the media. He's trying to corral their phone records and spy on their travels and conversations. And yet when he wants to meet them, he can't even have it be a transparent discussion. But I personally think that sort of misses the whole point of this. He's not talking to reporters in a press conference setting. He's having a meeting with bureau chiefs to talk about policy and to get their input. You know, it's a two-way conversation he's proposing to have so the media have a chance to get their say. So to the extent that this meeting is a story, the bureau chiefs are part of the story. They're protagonists in the story. They can't then go out and write a story about themselves. That's not journalism. So it's not I don't think it's that strange a request for a Holder to have made. You know, maybe you farm out the story to some other reporter and then you have to deal with whether it's off the record. I can only talk about this in kind of oblique terms, blah, blah, blah. But how else is the media heads going to have a chance to shape policy unless it's in that kind of a two-way dialogue setting? I mean, it seems like they can't accept that they're the dog that got the truck and they can't just be happy about it.
Well, apparently there's something unseemly about it because the New York Times says it would be inappropriate for them to attend. And I know Ron Fournier at the National Journal, I believe formerly at the AP, has a big piece up about why it would be wrong for them to attend, to accede to attend this off-the-record meeting. I can only say that I think that the main allegations, the Rosen stuff, and he's a co-conspirator, and the AP seizing of phone records, obviously troubles me greatly. And I think that in terms of optics, it is interesting. I mean, asking these media heads to go to the meeting and have it be off the record, it plays into the image of secrecy and co-opting, and maybe there'll be pressure. I mean, we don't know what he's going to say. Maybe there would be intimidation, and they couldn't write about it because of this, you know, because they've agreed to some off-the-record thing. So I think that fundamentally Holder has lost the trust and the confidence of the journalism world, and once that happens, it's a problem. I wonder how long he's going to hold on. You're starting to see people say he should go, and not just the usual suspects. So let me ask you that, Bill. I mean, it sounds like you're defending Holder. You like him, but shouldn't, for the sake of Barack Obama's presidency, wouldn't it be better? Look, I thought that Rumsfeld and I even thought Cheney should go. I thought that Bush should have replaced Cheney and with someone to run, then he would have had a successor, and it would have changed the tone of the Bush administration. I mean, don't you think it would be better? Holder's had a good run. Might it be good for Barack Obama if Eric Holder decided to spend a little more time with his family?
Well, just to go into your earlier point, though, I mean, if Holder was going to do something, you know, unseemly and try to intimidate them in private quarters, that would not stop bureau chiefs from, you know, leaking up a storm about that. Even if they didn't quote him directly because it was technically off the record, there's still been the media. They would find a way, I think, to get that information out to the rest of the world. So I would be surprised if Holder was going to play the heavy in that kind of arrangement.
Well, I think too, though. I mean, I think that there's if you're a media outlet like the New York Times, you're seen as being liberal leaning, and if you agree to go to this off the record meeting, it really looks bad. I mean, it really looks like here Holder and the Justice Department have done some things which are really problematic, and they've been chastised by journalists for doing it. And now all of a sudden, you go into this meeting with him, and it looks like you're being sort of co-opted. So I think it does present an optics problem for the outlets themselves.
I mean,
we saw last – was it just like last week someone tweeted, you know, a journalist tweeted that like Ezra Klein and Jonathan Capehart and a couple of other, you know, left-leaning journalists were being summoned, had been summoned to the White House. And then like a couple of days later, a couple of the people who were on the list had stories calling for, it was calling for Lois Lerner's ouster. I think that's what it was. So there appeared to be some coordination taking place. And I think that these outlets are sensitive to the fact that people believe that they're sort of in the hip pocket of the administration.
I mean, I think people can judge the journalists based on what they put out. I think all these outlets have been playing tough on the Obama administration at various times. So, and they're certainly being tough on them right now. So, I mean, if they had that meeting, all of a sudden everything was a whitewash after that, then yeah, that would look bad. I highly doubt that's what would occur. But look, if the Times doesn't want to do it, they think it's inappropriate. I mean, that's their call. I mean, they can do what they want to do. But they are –
Well, think of it. The New York Times is freer now. Having said no to the meeting, the New York Times can now defend Holder and look better.
I mean,
it would have looked bad if they went to the meeting and then came out and defended the administration.
Well, I mean, they would, but I don't – I mean, the Times – all these media outlets are in, you know, high, you know, pitchfork – you know, waving of the fist. How dare you ever investigate us for anything? So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that really pushes their buttons. I don't think they're looking for an out to hug Holder on this issue. But if they want to maintain what they think is a proper professional adversarial posture to people in power, I mean, hey, that's totally their business. But if they want to share practical concerns and see if they can actually change policies that affect them directly. You know, the media is sort of a weird business in that it's half business and half, you know, journalism. On the business end, you want to talk to other people in power to try to shape their policies that affect you, which, let's be honest, happens all the time. If they don't want to do it in this instance, that's their business, but they're missing an opportunity to bend Holder's ear when he's a little vulnerable and perhaps get him to change the policies in a certain way. But that's their call. But to answer your other question, should Holder go? I'm not convinced that this at all hurts Obama in any respect, whether it's politically. I don't think it's hurting his poll numbers. And subsequently, I don't think it's hurting his agenda. Immigration is the big live issue now, and it's proceeding apace. So if anything, Holder is playing the role of the lightning rod that's absorbing the outrage from the right and not letting it get to Obama. And Ashcroft often played that role for Bush. And Bush even, you know, patted him on the back for doing that for him in his first term. So it's not like there's no actual charge of scandal here. No one has argued that Holder or the Justice Department broke the law in doing what they did. There's a complaint about what the impact might be, but there's no serious charge. They weren't allowed to do what they did under current law. So I don't see where the scandal, quote unquote, could go in a way that would be even more oxygen sucking for Obama. Right now, it seems it's kind of like in a nice place for Obama, where like it's keeping outrage over here and not over at the immigration bill over here. And so, as long as that dynamic's in place, you know, what's the harm?
Interesting theory. You may be right, Bill. It's an argument.
and the thing that he was doing, I mean, let's keep in mind what the objective here was. He's trying to stop what they consider to be a very serious national security leak. He's not trying to arrest journalists, but they're clearly being hard on communication between leakers and journalists, trying to find out what happened. And I made the same.
Well, but come on, I mean, you know, what they did with James Rosen, especially, was beyond the pale. I mean, going through his emails, you know, basically arguing that he is like a co-conspirator to do it. It's really
I made the same argument during the Plame investigation. Horrible. So I'm personally being insistent about this. When the leak is the crime, the leak itself, the communication from the government official to the journalist, that is the crime. The only way to prosecute that crime is to investigate the communication. I mean, there's no other. If you can't
right,
do that,
no,
you can't investigate the crime.
But we have a thing called the rule of law. I mean, that's like saying, well, we know this person is a burglar, and the only way to find out for sure is to search his house. Well, but there's rules that say you can't do that.
But there's no charge here.
Then there's no charge. You can't prosecute.
There's no charge that a justice violated rules in doing this. There's a charge that how they're implementing the rules might chill investigative journalism. I understand the concern about that. But in order
to get access to Rosen's personal emails, they had to allege that he was somehow, you know, possibly involved in a crime.
I mean, my understanding of the situation is, in getting the authority to do that, they followed the rules. Now, if they found that they didn't follow the rules, then sure, they should be busted for not following the rules. I have no argument for violating rules. But my understanding is they were allowed to say, here's the facts as we know them. Rosen.
If here's the thing, if somebody is a co-conspirator, then you can go through their emails. It seems very likely to me. They just said that a reporter who was doing his job was a co-conspirator, so they could go through the emails. So we obviously see this thing very different.
I have no problem with it being investigated so all the full facts about it. If someone broke the rules or did something disingenuous to kind of, you know, work a way around the rules, I don't think that's correct. I don't think that's the situation.
I mean, do you think that if someone is a journalist at the New York Times and someone leaks them information, you know, that the Bush White House didn't want out, that the Bush White House could then go through the personal emails of a New York Times reporter,
and that
would be legal and hockey-dory?
I mean, the press has a legal right in the First Amendment to publish information. You know, I'm not disputing that. If information was given to them in an illegal fashion, then the government has the right and obligation to investigate that communication, and they should do it through proper means, legal subpoenas, search warrants, and all that sort of thing. But my understanding of the Rosen case is, you know, he had created a system of secret codes, you know, proactively, the journalist, to get the leaker to give him this information, and that was the base of saying he was a co-conspirator. And they said co-conspirator not to get Rosen in jail. They're not trying to get Rosen in jail, but to say they have grounds to investigate the communication. Because there was this elaborate procedure created to extract illegal information, classified information.
I can't believe how authoritarian you are, man. This is what reporters do, journalists do. Yeah, meet me in the garage. And, you know, Bob Novak used to have people, you know, I talked about David Ferdoso earlier. I mean, he worked for Novak. I mean, Novak helped prevent, you know, possible wars because people would, like, leave a briefcase in some, you know, restroom somewhere that he would happen to be at Union Station or something and pick up. And then Novak would write about how, you know, the Clinton administration, the Reagan administration, whatever. I mean, so this is a function. I mean, journalists do that. This is what they do. I mean, and
some journalists push the bounds of what's legal to do that sometimes, and sometimes it's for the greater good. Sometimes, you know, you want a journalist to, you know, break a few rules to get important information out to the world. There are activists that do civil disobedience, you know, in the same respect. If you do that, you know, you're not immune to the law. You might have the best intentions. You might be in the larger right. But if you broke the law along the way, you might have to suffer some consequences for that. And that's just, you know, life. Again, life isn't fair. But in this case, Rosen's not even being charged with anything.
That's the point. They alleged that he was a co-conspirator, not because they actually intended to charge him, because he wasn't guilty, so that they could invade his privacy and look at his personal emails. That makes it worse, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I got to leave it there because I have to jump into a meeting. I'm already a little late. But we'll agree to disagree.
I enjoyed our conversation about how we're being
more. I'm going to go make sure the government looks at your emails now. And we'll talk next week.
All right, man. Thanks. Care.